A running mate, but we will know within the next week as the Republican National Convention begins Monday in Milwaukee. ABC's Jay O'Brien is there.
Republican sources tell me that they have relished the recent weeks where scrutiny has been on their opponents as Democrats grapple with President Biden's candidacy, but they acknowledge that here in Milwaukee soon, the spotlight will shift back onto the GOP and onto Trump.
President Biden, meanwhile, continues his push to reassure Democrats, although more call on him to step out of the presidential race. That includes California Democrat Mike Levin. Multiple sources tell ABC he told the president that message during a meeting with the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. The Hamas-controlled Gaza Health Ministry says at least 70 people were killed in an Israeli strike on a designated safe zone. This is ABC News. A judge threw out Rudy Giuliani's bankruptcy case, finding the former mayor of New York City flouted the process with a lack of transparency. More from ABC's Erica Tursky in New York.
A federal bankruptcy judge dismissed Rudy Giuliani's bankruptcy case. And that means that Giuliani, who sought to be shielded from about $150 million in debt, most of it to a couple of Georgia election workers that he defamed, he's not going to be shielded anymore because the judge said it was in the interest of those creditors and others to dismiss the bankruptcy case and allow them to start to collect from Giuliani.
U.S. Forest Service, a helicopter responding to a small wildfire in central Idaho, crashed into the Sawtooth National Forest. Pilot survived and was able to hike to an ambulance. A day before, a firefighting aircraft crashed into a reservoir near Helena, Montana. The pilot did not survive. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
Hi, welcome to Staples.
Hi, my son's teacher emailed his back-to-school list. He needs crayons and a comp book for every subject.
Okay, no problem. With Staples Hot Deals, you'll find super low prices on hundreds of items for back-to-school.
Oh, now they're saying he needs folders and glue.
You got it.
And markers?
Of course.
Oh, geez.
Can we get a cart? Please.
Save big on back to school with Staples Hot Deals. Right now, 24-pack Crayola crayons and comp books are only 50 cents each at Staples. Ends 8/24, in-store only, limit 30.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinaire on Air with Jane Matinaire. Weekdays 10 till noon on the talk of Green Bay, 97.9 FM and 1590 AM WGBW, and on the Civic Media app.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section at WGBW.FM.
The back seat. Check the back seat.
Gets in your head, right? Good, because every year dozens of children are forgotten in the back seat. Cars get hot fast and can be deadly. So get it in your head. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. A recent poll shows how older voters view the race for president. Mike Moan reports.
The poll in this crucial battleground state, released by AARP, was conducted right after the first debate between President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump. In Wisconsin, Trump now leads Biden by 6 percentage points among voters 18 and up, according to this new survey. Pollster Bob Ward helped lead the effort, and he points out that a very high percentage of voters 50 and older are extremely motivated to cast their ballot, more so than younger populations.
There's typically a motivation gap, but not by the size that we're seeing now. And that's what makes this election really different and why it makes the voters 50 plus such a key deciding block in the electorate.
83% of voters 50 and older said a candidate's position on Social Security is very important in shaping their vote. Medicare was at 72%. More than 1,000 likely voters around Wisconsin were interviewed, with an oversampling of nearly 450 likely voters past the age of 50. The age of the leading presidential candidates is dominating national rhetoric about the election, but Ward emphasizes that under this poll, voters strongly indicate they're not too happy about their economic situation.
The debate had its impact on this race, but I think the fundamentals of this race is that people are really feeling an economic pinch.
Despite a strong jobs market, economic factors like inflation and rising prices were cited as a key concern among older adults. Ward says it appears President Biden is taking the blame for that sentiment, but overall, both candidates are not looked at favorably. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Highs in the upper 80s today, lots of sunshine. Showers and thunderstorms possible tonight, a low around 70. Showers and thunderstorms for Sunday, it'll be hot and humid with a high near 91. For Monday, a high near 89 under mostly sunny skies.
Currently 75 degrees.
John Mino and Jim Schmidt.
On our next show, we'll check in with Brittany Merlot for a look at the forecast for the weekend. Brian Kuklinski swings in from the Green Bay Rockers.
Then we'll play a round of Who Are You? That'll be fun.
Well, that's debatable. Join us.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
Welcome to this, our weekly weekend venued broadcast. My name is Jim Santel, and yes, I am your host this weekend for Amicus, a law review. This is the 106th broadcast since we've been on the air of the networks of Civic Media, since going on the air in the summer of 2022. Thank you so much for joining me on this weekend. We take our name, our adopted commission, as always, to conduct review and analysis, some deliberation, some consideration even of the recent news of our times in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice. All of that comes from the word amicus. It's a legal term, as you now well know. It's derived from the Latin, and that means a friend, ami, an individual, an organization that assists somehow in understanding or appreciation or assessment of some relevant issues or questions, things that need resolution by a court, a judge, some entity out there for decision-making in our lives. And so it is Amicus, a law review that is a part of your weekend on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Once again, honored to have you with me for our discussion about all things justice-related, government-related, and law-related as well. We have been speaking for the past several broadcasts about the major news stories of our time coming from the United States Supreme Court. This is the last in our series, at least for this term, talking about the Supreme Court. We're going to go back and recall that over the period of the last several broadcasts, we have talked about these major cases, about 15, maybe even 20 of them altogether, in the areas of social media and gun rights, in abortion access, in free speech, racial gerrymandering, the rights of the homeless, opioid settlements, issues related to cross-state pollution. And yes, these major cases, also in the areas of administrative action, agency deference, and the federal connection to them, and significantly, what is now the most significant, important case, not only of this term, but arguably of our lifetimes, this major decision from the United States Supreme Court, embracing the notion that there is presidential immunity for our chief executive in the White House for crimes that he, perhaps one day she, has in fact committed. All of those things have been on our docket of recent broadcasts, and we are going to revisit at least the last of those in this broadcast, this weekend program, by reviewing once again the key elements of that major case, Trump versus United States, issued by our United States Supreme Court on July 1 of this year, that changes our Constitution, that affects the ways in which government interacts with other branches of government internally and also with us as well, changes the way in which our society in America lives and breathes on a regular basis. Cannot overstate the significance of that. Indeed, Noah Feldman, who is a law professor at Harvard Law School, recently wrote that he said the Supreme Court in this case has gutted the historic effort to hold Donald Trump legally accountable for his efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Professor Feldman went on to say this. He said a president tried to break our democracy by overturning the results of an election that he lost, and the Supreme Court has responded by protecting him from criminal prosecution. Our founders, Professor Feldman says, would be horrified. The Caesars would nod in approval. Today, as a part of our syllabus, we're taking up what Professor Feldman has said, and we're once again going to review the key elements of that order, that decision by our Supreme Court that changes our Constitution, changes the interaction between the branches of government, changes the ways in which we ourselves interact with our government, and have understandings about the fundamental notions of rule of law. We're going to go back and review some of the fundamental key pieces of that decision. And then as we move forward, we're going to talk about the impact of this immunity decision on the other trials, the other cases that are pending in the federal district and the state district trial courts of our nation. We're going to talk about the impact of the immunity decision on the federal election interference case, presently still pending in front of Judge Tanya Chutkan. She, as you know, is the district court judge in the District of Columbia. She is responsible for presiding over the four-count indictment alleging conspiracy, alleging deprivation of rights, four different counts, some of them under Section 1512 of Title 18 of the United States Code, also the subject of this other case involving Fisher that we have talked about. But she now has to wrestle not only with Fisher and the impact of that decision, but also significantly the impact of this finding that our chief executive does, in fact, have immunity in many ways, virtually all ways, for crimes committed in office. We're going to talk about the specific applications of this immunity decision for what Tanya Chutkan has right before her as she goes forward and conducts these hearings that presumably the United States Supreme Court wants her to conduct in analyzing the standards, the facts of the case now before. We're going to go inside what those notions, those concepts are all about, and identify the great challenges now before Tanya Chutkan, U.S. District Court judge, as she attempts to make sense of all of this in that trial now once again before her. We're going to spend some time also talking about the impact of this immunity decision on the Mar-a-Lago documents case, the so-called documents matter involving both confidential documents and other documents that the president took from the White House, maintained at Mar-a-Lago, used them perhaps, bandied them about, all of those allegations in that Mar-a-Lago document case pending in front of U.S. District Court Judge Eileen Cannon. She is in the Southern District of Florida. She has an office, a courtroom in Fort Pierce, Florida. We're going to talk about what is happening in connection with this immunity decision and the case that she has in front of her. It's different, as you know, from the case pending in front of Tanya Chutkan. That case has to do with classified and other confidential documents. The election interference case, something different. Both of them, however, federal cases, both of them involving the same defendant, Donald Trump, both of them being prosecuted by Special Counsel Jack Smith. We're going to talk about the impact of this immunity decision on those two prosecutions that continue now on the dockets of those two judges in those two districts. And then we're going to move to the state courts as well. We know as well that recently Donald Trump was convicted of violations of New York law having to do with false statements, false representations in a so-called hush money case prosecuted by Alvin Bragg, the district attorney there in Manhattan, pending in front of Juan Merchan. Juan Merchan had previously, as you know, scheduled a sentencing hearing for just this past week, decided based upon the requests and the concurrences of the parties to postpone that sentencing. Why? So he can determine whether or not this major immunity decision pending before him will have an impact upon what he has before him in deciding on the sentence to be imposed upon Donald Trump. A lot of things before Judge Merchan wants to make certain, as he always has, that he gets it right. And he is entertaining now briefs and oral arguments from the parties about the impact of this federal immunity Supreme Court decision on what Juan Merchan himself will do in handling the case. Does he have to dismiss counts? Does he have to continue with the sentencing? Should he continue with that sentencing as he has planned? What is the result? What is the impact of the decision there upon Juan Merchan's conduct of the hush money case as it goes to sentencing and final disposition before him, presumably also then going up to the Court of Appeals after that? Finally, in this broadcast of Amicus Law Review, we're going to turn to Georgia, which is the other state case, the other criminal case pending against Donald Trump and others there. That case being prosecuted in front of a judge, a state court judge named Scott McAfee. That's the one that also alleges election interference by Donald Trump and many, many others, some of whom have already pled guilty. That case also right now in the midst of pretrial proceedings of various kinds. We're going to talk about the impact of this decision by the Supreme Court, the things that Donald Trump's counsel, defense counsel, is advocating for in all of these courts, and the results of those coming from these judges in the wake of this momentous ruling from the United States Supreme Court, all of them rule of law related, all of them going to be impacted by what the Supreme Court did in the very last decision that it issued in this term on July 1 of 2024. No small things on our agenda for this broadcast of Amicus, a Law Review. We're going to continue with our discussion on these things. And then also as a part of our presentation, our engagement, tell you about some additional cases that the Supreme Court has already added to its docket for the 2024-2025 term. Yes, that's right. A year from now, we're going to be talking about these cases the Supreme Court has now agreed to review from lower courts. We're going to be talking about six or seven cases that just recently the Supreme Court added to its docket when it comes to deciding future things, coming in principally from the many federal circuits around our nation. We'll talk about those as they are the subjects of what are called writs of certiorari, those, as you know, these decisions by our Supreme Court to say, yes, indeed, these particular cases raise issues of things that are important to the courts, important, most importantly, to the people of the United States of America, things that we need to resolve, things that should be the matter of resolution by us, things that should, in fact, be addressed by the highest court in the land. We're going to tell you about seven or so of those cases as well. Now on the docket, now the attorneys in those cases representing various parties preparing their memorandums, looking forward to oral arguments beginning when? Beginning with a new term in 2024-2025. That begins again on October 1 of this year when the Supreme Court, first Monday in October, begins its work and then schedules oral argument, conducts the oral arguments of the same sort that it entertained in this term. All of that this weekend on Amicus, a Law Review. Again, appreciating your time, your attention, your focus at this time in our nation's history when the world is changing, our nation is changing, our understanding of law and government and the aspiration for justice is ever changed.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
Do you owe back taxes? Call Tax Solutions now and get some help. For a limited time, the IRS offers a tax forgiveness program called the Fresh Start Initiative. Our team can make it easier for you to pay back taxes, avoid tax liens, and get a fresh start.
I call Tax Solutions now, and they got the IRS off my back.
Call Tax Solutions now. 800-281-8193. 800-281-8193. 800-281-8193.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Again, we're talking about Julian Assange, villain or hero. Karen from Madison, you're on the air. What do you think?
I studied that Edward Snowden. You know, maybe I don't know as much about Julian, but I'm trying to learn more. And I just want to thank everybody for helping me learn.
Thank you for being open to learning more about issues and delving into them here on the Civic Media Radio Network. That is what it's all about.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matt Nair on air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a la revue. My name is Jim Santel, your host this weekend for our weekly roundup of all things justice-related, rule of law-related, government-related. We have this ambitious but achievable agenda, the syllabus for this weekend's broadcast. I'm going to begin with a bit of a review, a synopsis, if you will, of the major decision issued by the Supreme Court. Arguably the most important decision of our lifetimes, because it does, in fact, change not only the relationship between the branches of government, but changes the very constitutional structure by which our government has operated for 248 years. It is brand new, and we will see its impact in the days and weeks and months and years ahead. But we know that it will have an impact upon these four cases pending now in the states and the federal courts around our country, the election interference case pending in the District of Columbia court in front of Tanya Chutkan, that Mar-a-Lago documents case pending in front of Judge Eileen Cannon in South Florida, that hush money matter that was the result of a verdict coming out of a jury of a number of weeks ago in front of Juan Merchan, sentencing now scheduled for September. And also the pending case in front of Scott McAfee, the Georgia judge, who has got that election interference case there, allegations that Donald Trump and many others violated Georgia law when it comes to the attempt to undermine and to overthrow the election of 2020. All of those being impacted by this important decision. The case is Trump versus United States. Issued on July 1, 2024. It goes in the annals of our history and in the law books for all time. It will now be taught in law schools around the country. Some very interesting articles and writings already by deans and by other academics out there who are saying for the first time that now they need to revise their own syllabuses for the real-world law school classes that they teach, trying to figure out how it is they meld this particular opinion with traditional notions that they've taught, that they've instructed for generations of law students, changing this fall and into the future as this case goes forward. Let's go back and revisit some fundamental things that the Supreme Court said about executive immunity and the limitations now imposed in the case, at least with respect to the election interference prosecution in front of Tanya Chutkan. Here's how Chief Justice John Roberts begins. He says, at least with respect to the president's exercise of his core constitutional powers, the immunity must be absolute, meaning no possibility of prosecution. Now, he tells us an awful lot more about that in the words and senses to come, but he follows it up by saying, as for his remaining official actions, things not in the Constitution, he is also presumptively immune. We'll talk more about what that means as well. And then the Chief Justice, through the auspices of the court, the majority of the court, goes on to describe this very vigorous and muscular executive branch in a way that is beyond even the language and the content, the tone, the tenor of the articles of the Constitution themselves. He says this: the framers sought to encourage energetic, vigorous, decisive, and speedy execution of the laws by placing in the hands of a single, constitutionally indispensable individual the ultimate authority that, in respect of the other branches, the Constitution divides among many. Goes on to say their design, meaning the founders, did not envision counterproductive burdens on the vigor and the energy of the executive. And he's talking there, of course, about a prosecution of a sitting or past president. He goes on to say this. Where does this all come from? The separation of powers, he says, those principles necessitate at least a presumptive immunity, a presumption that immunity applies from criminal prosecution for a president's acts within the outer perimeter of his official responsibility. Now, that sounds very wonky, doesn't it? Sounds like a lawyer writing, and indeed it is. But he's describing generally the core responsibilities of a chief executive. He says that immunity is required, mandated to safeguard the independence and effective functioning of the executive branch and to enable the president to carry out his constitutional duties without undue caution. Very important language there. We don't want to impose upon a president the obligation to engage in cautionary deliberation. Obviously, advocating for just the opposite here on this broadcast. But that's what our Supreme Court justices, the majority of them, said. Went on to say this about the burdens imposed by a prosecution. Said, at a minimum, the president must be immune from prosecution for an official act unless, and here it comes, unless the government can show that applying a criminal prohibition to that act would pose no dangers of intrusion on the authority and functions of the executive branch. Now, once again, that language, which admittedly I'm emphasizing for dramatic effect here, no dangers of intrusion. Well, of course, every single prosecution, criminal prosecution, civil litigation, administrative proceedings, they're intrusions into lives, sometimes appropriate, sometimes not. But every single piece of litigation in our courts does just that. And yet, the government now is required to show that the continuation of this prosecution and others would pose no such burden on the executive branch. I would offer an impossible thing for a prosecutor to show. And then let's talk about intent. In dividing official from unofficial conduct, which is this separation that the Supreme Court is gauged in now, very much refuted, dismissed by the government, a fellow named Michael Dreeben, who is this outstanding, outstanding advocate from the Solicitor General's office, rejected this notion that somehow you can divide up crimes and say some of them are official, some of them are unofficial, some of them are personal, some of them are not. Nonetheless, there it is in this opinion. The Supreme Court goes on to say, courts may not inquire into a president's motives. Stunning language. Courts may not inquire into the president's motives. Such an inquiry, the court goes on to say, would risk exposing even the most obvious instances of official conduct to judicial examination on the mere allegation of improper purpose, thereby intruding on the Article II interests that immunity seeks to protect. Now, all that language, again, sounds very, very sophisticated, but it means basically that you can't do in this particular prosecution what you do in every other criminal prosecution, which is talk about the purpose, the motive, the intent, the reason why the defendant did what he or she allegedly did. Juries want to know that, and indeed, it's a part of virtually every single prosecution that's out there. It's what's called an element of the offense. It's called intent. And motive and purpose are somewhat different legally in terms of the definitions that lawyers and judges give them. But nonetheless, that notion that the Supreme Court has shut down any inquiry in front of a jury about why it is that the allegations, as they're charged in this indictment, why it is that Donald Trump engaged in those, can't do them. And then there's this one. Trump is therefore absolutely immune from prosecution for the alleged conduct involving his discussions with Justice Department officials, applying that prohibition to the president's conversations with Department of Justice people would run afoul of those same considerations. That is a stunning affirmation of absolute immunity, and it underscores the significance of this kind of decision-making from the Supreme Court. Amicus Law Review continues with an exploration of that particular issue, and again, our application of all of this to those four other cases that are pending right now in the courts of our land.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Still no indication as to former President Trump's choice for a running mate, but we will know within the next week as the Republican National Convention begins Monday in Milwaukee. ABC's Jay O'Brien is there.
Republican sources tell me that they have relished the recent weeks where scrutiny has been on their opponents as Democrats grapple with President Biden's candidacy, but they acknowledge that here in Milwaukee soon, the spotlight will shift back onto the GOP and onto Trump.
President Biden, meanwhile, continues his push to reassure Democrats, although more call on him to step out of the presidential race. That includes California Democrat Mike Levin. Multiple sources tell ABC he told the president that message during a meeting with the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. The Hamas-controlled Gaza Health Ministry says at least 70 people were killed in an Israeli strike on a designated safe zone. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
The Brewers host the Nationals. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Game two of a three-game series as the Brewers host the Washington Nationals tonight. The Nationals won game one last night, 5-2. Milwaukee's Freddie Peralta, the losing pitcher, says he's looking forward to a stronger second half of the season like last year.
Like, my second half was really good. So now I'm just trying to clean my mind and just move forward.
Brewers manager Pat Murphy.
Can't start matching records and say, well, you should have done this, should have done that. I thought there was a lot of good in Freddie's outing.
NFL, Aaron Rodgers says he was in Egypt when he missed the Jets' mandatory minicamp. Rodgers golfing this weekend with A.J. Hawk and actor Miles Teller at a tournament in Lake Tahoe.
My Achilles feels good. It's just about getting back into it. I felt good all spring. Had a nice OTAs. Had a beautiful trip to Egypt. Summer's over on Sunday. Walking up 18 is like super bittersweet, but it's fun to be out here. Especially, I mean, A.J. and Miles, two of my best friends.
With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Highs in the upper 80s today, lots of sunshine. Showers and thunderstorms possible tonight, a low around 70. Showers and thunderstorms for Sunday, it'll be hot and humid with a high near 91. For Monday, a high near 89 under mostly sunny skies.
It's 76 at our studios.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
The Republican National Convention is being held in Milwaukee, and it marks the first time the RNC is in the Badger State. But Wisconsin holds a special spot in the election cycle, with the RNC the second consecutive political convention in Milwaukee. The city was picked for the Democratic National Convention in 2020, but due to COVID, most of it ended up being virtual. Do you know which city has hosted the most political conventions? Philadelphia, Chicago, or Boston? The answer coming up. Political conventions started in the 19th century. It remained the main way to select candidates until 1972, when presidential primaries determined the eventual nominee. Conventions are now considered more of a celebration of the candidate. So do you know which city has held the most political conventions? Chicago. The Republicans have been there 14 times, and the Democratic convention will be hosted there for the 11th time this summer. 50,000 people expected at the RNC in Milwaukee, a nice slice of Wisconsin for the country to see. I'm Terry.
The Todd Albaugh Show.
Brady joining us live via phone.
I tell the guys before every game, and honestly try to do it before every practice, challenge is going to come. This team is not just going to show up and allow us to walk all over them and win. Really what matters is how are we going to respond to that? Man, if you can adapt and use it as a learning opportunity, it's going to set you up to go accomplish darn near anything you want to.
I think there are a lot of people that need to hear that message today.
The Todd Albaugh Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, the Republican National Convention gets underway. We talked to Greg Treverton from National Security Leaders for America about the ramifications of a possible Trump second term.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a lot of you. My name, Jim Santel, and we are talking in this, our weekly weekend update on all things rule of law related, all about what the Supreme Court case of July 1 is all about, reviewing some things we talked about in our previous broadcast, but bringing them all together in a way that hopefully provides even more coherent exposition of what the Supreme Court did and did not say. Talking right now about one of the most stunning things that I read in this opinion. You are certainly free to disagree with that. That's America. That's what we embrace here also at Civic Media. The Department of Justice, which is the entity, the agency for which I worked for about 30 years of my career, is also the subject of one of the most stunning things in this opinion from the Supreme Court. Let me read this to you again. Donald Trump, the defendant, is therefore absolutely immune. Nothing to discuss here. Absolutely immune from prosecution for the alleged conduct in that indictment, the four counts, any of that having to do with engagements with the Department of Justice, involving discussions with Department of Justice officials. That is a stunning thing. It basically means that if involved in any discussions, in any interactions with Department of Justice people, the president can do whatever he, maybe one day she, wants to do. And we're going to talk specifically when we get to the specific trial in front of Tanya Chutkan about the horrifying impact of that language, that directive, on the trial before Tanya Chutkan. The court goes on to say that with respect to the other things in the indictment having to do with the vice president's conversations, those may well hinder the president's inability and ability to perform constitutional functions if indeed there's prosecution that goes forward as to those as well, the engagements with the vice president. Not absolutely immune, but presumptively immune. And oh, by the way, if in fact the government wants to present evidence of criminal conduct by this defendant, the government has the burden to rebut a presumption of immunity. Now, what does that mean? Basically means that the government is the one that has to come forward and say once again that the prosecution of this case, the presentation to a jury, the review and the presentation of evidence in support of that indictment, all of that would not affect in any way the conduct of the executive branch. Again, an impossible standard to reach. I do not know how a prosecutor, including Jack Smith, would overcome that. That applies to all of the things not related to the Department of Justice, for which we don't even have to get there, because as to the Department of Justice, there is complete, absolute immunity. Anything goes. And as I've said before, when one thinks back on history, 1972, 1973, 1974, the end of the Nixon administration, the start of the Ford administration, Richard Nixon, calling to say that he wants his presidency back, right? He wants his presidency back because this is exactly what Richard Nixon did that got him into the criminal trouble that he was in. He was engaging with the Department of Justice, his Attorney General, John Mitchell, in engaging in conspiracy to obstruct justice. And when he did that, he was engaging in specifically the kinds of communications and engagements the Department of Justice normally engages in with a president. And now, according to this decision by the Supreme Court, now no longer under any circumstances can be the subject of prosecution by a sitting president. Absolute immunity for anything that Richard Nixon would have done had this rule, this standard, been around back at that time. And certainly going forward now, complete absolute immunity for things that a president does while engaging with his Department of Justice. There is more, of course, in this opinion. Let's talk about some of the evidentiary things that are also going to be a part of this trial. Here's what the Chief Justice says about what this trial is going to look like. He says this: a proposal that a jury consider evidence concerning the president's official acts, and that such evidence would be admissible to prove, for example, knowledge or intent of the falsity of election fraud claims, that threatens to eviscerate the immunity we have recognized. What is that all about? Again, lots of words, lots of legal stuff going on there. The jury in this matter cannot consider evidence of the president's official acts, even if they're not of a criminal nature.
You can't present evidence of the things that he is authorized to do to prove up the things that he did, which were criminal. The court goes on to say that kind of thing would permit a prosecutor to do indirectly what he cannot do directly. That is, invite the jury to examine acts from which a president is immune to nonetheless prove his liability on any charge. Again, a lot of language there. Basically, carving out for the first time a situation where a prosecutor cannot establish the core obligations of a public official, constitutional, statutory, can't describe those to a jury, can't have the jury consider evidence about official acts to prove those things that he or she did wrong in violation of those very standards. It is ridiculous. And no, you don't have to be a lawyer to figure that out. The court goes on to say, in response to much of what the Department of Justice pushed back on when it comes to that, Department of Justice at the time of the oral argument in their briefs said that there are all sorts of protections out there to make certain that there's no abuse here, nothing wrong going on here. We do this in all of these cases. Court has a response to that, too. The judge, Chief Justice, says this: trial tools like evidentiary rulings and jury instructions are unlikely to protect adequately the president's constitutional prerogatives. Evidentiary rulings, which judges do all the time, that's what judges are supposed to do. And jury instructions, that's how juries understand the law, apply the law to the facts. But those things now, according to John Roberts, those are not protecting the prerogatives of the president, the constitutional things we're saying. Those prosaic tools, when's the last time you would use the word prosaic? Comes from the word prose, basically means ordinary, commonplace, as opposed to poetry. Those prosaic tools on which the government would have courts rely are an inadequate safeguard. This is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court talking against the peculiar constitutional concerns implicated in the prosecution of a former president. Oh, my goodness. All the things we think about when it comes to a federal trial, a state trial, a criminal trial, frankly, a civil trial, those basic trappings, evidence, decisions about what comes in, what doesn't come in, jury instructions, all those things, those are inadequate. And so, government, don't tell me about those things because those don't apply here. And indeed goes on, makes the point even more clear in case you're not clear on it already. The Chief Justice says this on behalf of the majority. The Justice Department's longstanding commitment, and yes, the Supreme Court acknowledged that, says that there is a commitment to impartial enforcement of the law, as well as the criminal justice system's further protections. All those things we get, the Supreme Court says. Those protections are things like, oh, for example, grand juries. Yes, indeed, that's in the Constitution of the United States of America. A defendant's procedural rights during trial, which have to be protected. Those things are out there as well, a part of our tradition for 250 years. The requirement that the government prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. Beyond a reasonable doubt. Everybody in America knows that language, right? Not just from television, from civics. You understand that completely. But all of those things, those trappings of criminal justice, none of those alleviate the need for pretrial review, which is the judge's way of saying that we're going to have the courts reexamine all of this. And they fail to address the fact that under our system of separate powers, criminal prohibitions cannot apply to presidential conduct to begin with. Stunning, stunning language, right? The Justice Department's longstanding commitment, all these things that are part of criminal process, they simply are inadequate. They fail to address our concerns here. They do not apply to one person in America, and that is the chief executive. And then the court goes on to say, as if that's not enough, that, oh, by the way, yes, there are these dissents. They're written by some people who don't understand what we're talking about. The Chief Justice writes this. He says, as for those dissents, they strike a tone of chilling doom that is wholly disproportionate to what the court actually does today. Oh my, condescending and dismissive of the dissents. In a situation where the court has not only changed dramatically the nature of our constitutional mechanisms, changed the way in which our government works, changed the Constitution, the very things that we've relied upon for 250 years, but then also establishes inside this upcoming trial. And yes, I'm going to offer for the other trials as well, those other proceedings pending in other courts, a radically different way of presenting evidence, what a jury can decide, what it cannot review, and the kinds of trappings that always attend defendants to ensure that rights are protected, including motions for evidentiary rulings, jury instructions, grand jury processes, all those things. None of those things is adequate, according to our Supreme Court. And I would offer again, in the context that I offered it in discussing Supreme Court Justice Sam Alito, that this too is the kind of contempt and the incivility toward the basic trappings of our government that should get everyone pause. Our Supreme Court has basically disregarded, at least with respect to this very popular and very muscular notion of a presidency that they're trying to advance here, this very, very robust notion that all of these things, these trappings of criminal justice, do not apply to a president, apparently because we've got to have a very active, a vital, and vigorous presidency, and that would be stopped if indeed we were to stop for the prosecution of a president who has committed crimes. Stunning results. Now, Amy Coney Barrett, as we have said before, is the one justice in the so-called conservative side of this bench that takes some exception. She joins with the overall result here. Let's be very clear on that. And her concurring opinion, which is really a dissenting opinion as to a portion of this, does not do anything to rescind her overall support for what the Supreme Court has done, what the Chief Justice has articulated in this order. But she does say this: properly conceived, the president's constitutional protection from prosecution is narrow. She says it's narrow. And that is her first foray, if you will, into saying, you know what? Maybe we've gone a little bit too far. This is Amy Coney Barrett, which we have seen in other settings, beginning to distance herself from her so-called conservative partners on the bench. She goes on to say this: the Constitution, again, in direct opposition to what the Chief Justice has said about these things that would separate the evidence that can and cannot be presented to a jury, she says, the Constitution does not require blinding juries to circumstances surrounding conduct for which presidents can, in fact, be liable. You don't have to blind juries. They know what they're doing. She says, I appreciate the court's concern that allowing into evidence official acts for which the president cannot be held liable may prejudice the jury. I get that. But the rules of evidence are equipped to handle that. That is a direct refutation of this notion that the rules do not apply and that there are not sufficient safeguards. The rules of evidence are equipped to handle that concern on a case-by-case basis. Most importantly, Amy Coney Barrett says, a trial court can exclude evidence of a president's protected conduct if its probative value is substantially outweighed by a danger of unfair prejudice or confusing the issues. Now, that's taken right out of an evidence code. It is a lot to consume, I know, but what she's saying basically is that, yes, judges do this all the time. They say, you know what, that's too much. That's too much, Mr. Santel. That's too much to present to the jury. That's confusing. That's unfair prejudice. And they can tell a prosecutor not to do that. That's how this works. We do not have to restrict the prosecution going into this to begin with. And that's Amy Coney Barrett's separation from the rest of the court. And that's why she separates herself, at least as to this, from the majority opinion. We've got more here on Amicus as we talk about the dissenters and then go on to chat about the application of all of this to those pending cases here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor. Donald Trump brags he nominated the justices who overturned Roe v. Wade, getting rid of the constitutional right to abortion.
Well, I did something that nobody thought was possible. I got rid of Roe v. Wade. For 54 years, they were trying to get Roe v. Wade terminated, and I did it, and I'm proud to have done it.
Donald Trump not only took away abortion rights, he wants to monitor pregnant women and punish those who seek an abortion. Just listen.
Do you believe in punishment for abortion? Yes or no, as a principle?
The answer is that there has to be some form of punishment.
For the woman?
Yeah.
Banning abortion, monitoring, and punishing women. That's how far Trump might go in a second term. Visit abetterwisconsintogether.org/TrumpMonitor to tell Donald Trump his views on abortion are too extreme for Wisconsin. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together, Inc.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name, Jim Santel, and we are marching through this life-changing opinion, this constitution-changing opinion of our United States Supreme Court, Trump versus United States, July 1, 2024. It's now in the annals of our history. It is in the law books of America. It is the law of the United States of America until someone changes it. And yes, indeed, a future Supreme Court could change it. The Congress could enter into this fray and pass legislation changing some of these principles. All of these things, of course, could be subject to future review. But we know that right now, the law of the United States is as the Chief Justice has articulated it. Amy Coney Barrett's dissent, if you will, as to the evidentiary consideration, does not change the core position in the Supreme Court opinion about those presentations in the trial courts. Nor is it changed by the dissenters, and they are three. They are Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan and Titkanji Brown Jackson. We have talked already about the virulence of their objection to what they see happening to their court, to the institutions of government, to the Constitution, and yes, indeed, to the United States of America. We know that Sonia Sotomayor said that this overall opinion summarized here on this broadcast, she described it as a mockery of the principle foundational to our government, our Constitution, and the system of our government, that no man is above the law. We have often heard that phrase. In effect, although the majority denies it, Sonia Sotomayor is saying, we have now rescinded that notion because there is at least one man, maybe one day one woman, who is indeed above the law. And that person is the President of the United States of America. She says she talks about that a lot in her opinion. As I've done before, I commend again. Everyone's reading not only of the majority opinion, it is digestible. Yes, there are lots of legal things along the way that you can see and skip through without any loss of content or tone. But you can also get a sense of the flavor of these arguments. They are approachable. They are accessible. Indeed, when Sonia Sotomayor takes on the majority, her response is just that. It's understandable, it's coherent, and it makes sense in the wake of 250 years of history. Here's what she says about this notion advanced by the Supreme Court majority about a very muscular and powerful executive. She says the majority's single-minded fixation on the president's need for boldness and dispatch ignores the countervailing need for accountability and restraint. That's what our Constitution is all about, right? The framers were not so single-minded. In the Federalist Papers, after endeavoring to show that the executive designed by the Constitution combines all the requisites to energy, Alexander Hamilton asked a separate, equally important question. This is again from the pen of Sonia Sotomayor. Quoting Hamilton, does it also combine the requisites to safety in a Republican sense with a small r, a due dependence on the people, a due responsibility? The answer then, she says, was yes, based in part upon the president's vulnerability to prosecution in the common course of law. That's what our founding fathers said. The answer after today is no. She goes on to say, never in the history of our republic has a president had reason to believe that he would be immune from criminal prosecution if he, one day she, used the trappings of his office to violate the criminal law. That's never happened before in the history of our nation. Moving forward, however, all former presidents will be cloaked in such immunity. If the occupant of that office misuses official power for personal gain, the criminal law that the rest of us, everybody else, all 330 million other Americans abide by these fundamental statutes, these fundamental rules and regulations, the criminal law that the rest of us must abide by will not provide a backup. And she says, with fear for our democracy, I dissent. That's Sonia Sotomayor. For with fear for our democracy, I dissent. We know that Elena Kagan also joins in those words. We know that Ketanji Brown Jackson also joins in those strong dissents. Note that when they describe their dissent as just that, they do not use the adverb respectfully. They do not use the word respectfully. They are angry about what's happened to this court. They're angry about what has happened to the Constitution, angry about what has happened to this nation. And indeed, that anger comes out as well in the related dissent from Ketanji Brown Jackson. She focuses on the fact that, gee, the Congress routinely establishes prohibitions. They establish the criminal laws pursuant to which we all have to behave, and those include laws that should apply to the president. She says, now, what is left of a greatly weakened Congress, which must stand idly by as the president disregards its criminal prohibitions, the things that it has set in statutes, and uses the power of his office to push the envelope while choosing to follow or not existing laws as he sees fit? That's Ketanji Brown Jackson saying, what about a Congress? What is their role in this? They've established that no one is above the law. They've established that there are statutes that apply. And now the Supreme Court has come along and said, wait, Congress, you cannot apply this law to one person. And that's the chief executive because of this muscular type of executive, this aggressive, energetic, nimble executive that plainly is contrary to what our founding fathers envisioned. And then she gives us a little bit of hope. She says, this is Ketanji Brown Jackson, as we entered into this completely uncharted territory, the people, that's you and me, that's all of us, in our wisdom, will need to remain ever attentive, consistently fulfilling their established role, the things we've done traditionally throughout our 250 years of history, in our constitutional democracy. This again, Ketanji Brown Jackson telling us we've got to do in the future, and thus collectively serving as the ultimate safeguard against any chaos spawned by this court's decision. We're the ones, we're the stopgaps, we're the guidelines against this. Because the risks, she says, and power the court has now assumed are intolerable, unwarranted, and plainly antithetical to bedrock constitutional norms, I dissent. That's Ketanji Brown Jackson. Likewise saying, not respectfully, I am horrified by what I see. I oppose this. And I will predict, she says, that this at some point will be taken back by the people of the United States of America. We continue with our application of all this to the pending cases in the courts, federal and state, as Amicus, a law review, continues in this, our second hour of our weekend broadcast.
This is the talk of Green Bay, WGBW. Pete Schwabba.
Monday night, we will stream live on Facebook, X, and YouTube from 7 to 8 p.m. during the RNC and be back on the air live from 8 to 9 p.m., where we welcome the master of radio magic, Gizmo.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights 7 till 9.
Are you ready to start a meaningful career in healthcare? Are you looking for a job that fits your work-life balance? Become a certified direct care professional today and make life better for older adults or people with a disability.
Wish Caregiver Careers makes it easy. With free online training plus earn a $500 bonus. See your name on Wisconsin's Certified Direct Care Registry. Sign up today at wiscaregiverscdcp.com. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.